From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democratic committee chairs are calling for the Mueller report to be made public by April 2nd. Republicans are taking an understandable victory lap, even though Attorney General William Barr's summation of the report said President Trump was not exonerated from obstruction. Meanwhile, President Trump says some people have done treasonous things that will be looked at. Senate Republican Judiciary Chair Lindsey Graham is calling for a new special counsel to look into how the Mueller investigation was carried out. Let's bring in Congressman James Comer. He's the Republican from Kentucky. And Congressman, first, your thoughts on the Barr summary.
Well, first of all, I'm glad that it's finally complete. It should have taken a year instead of 2 years. But the question's been answered. Did President Trump collude with Russia? And that's clearly no. I think we need to move on as a country. But I do also think that we need to investigate the genesis of this whole Mueller investigation, and that all began with the Steele dossier, with a few people at the Department of Justice that clearly had a bias towards President Trump. So I think there's still a lot of questions that need to be answered, but I'm just glad that the report has finally concluded and hopefully we can move on as a country.
Well, let's pick up a couple of things there. The Steele dossier was actually an investigation that was begun by the Republicans when they were looking to attack President or then candidate Donald Trump. But when he became the obvious front runner, they dropped it and the Democrats picked up the work of the Republicans. So it was the Republicans who had started that dossier. And there were questions about the Russians long before any of these investigations started, about some of the concerns in our security agencies about Russian interference in the 2016 election. Do you believe, as William Barr does and Mueller does, that the Russians interfered in the 2016 election?
Yes, I do. Specifically, they were part of a group that I believe tried to hack some emails that we all know about.
Mm-hmm.
They also tried to purchase some Facebook ads. Now, I do not think that their efforts had any impact on the final results of the election. But at any rate, Russia's a bad actor. Vladimir Putin's a bad person. I voted for sanctions against Russia. But if you look at the Russian interference in the 2016 election, that was while Obama was president. And the question that a lot of Democrats had was the Trump campaign colluding with Russia? And now we know without a shadow of a doubt that they were not.
Well, let me ask you about that, because given that you are someone who does believe the Russians interfered, are you at all concerned that President Trump then fired James Comey because of that Russia thing? He dismissed it. He dismissed the interference for the longest time. Are you concerned further that even though Barr did not determine that Mueller found collusion, he defined collusion as an agreement? And there were all these other things that might have not been a contract written up with Russia to collude, but you had a former campaign chair, Manafort, handing over polling data to a Russian, a meeting in Trump Tower to get dirt from Russians on Hillary Clinton. If not collusion, do those things concern you? And are you concerned at what we might learn when the Mueller report comes out, perhaps not a formal agreement with Russia, might not look so good?
Well, first of all, with Comey, I lost confidence in James Comey with the way he handled the situation with Hillary Clinton and her emails. I think that he did irreparable damage to Hillary Clinton. You know, you've had so many people switch sides. I know that the Democrats were cheering on Rod Rosenstein, and now that he agreed with General Barr that there was no obstruction of justice, I hear a lot of my Democrat colleagues in Washington now criticizing Rosenstein.
You're right. I mean, people have just been switching sides like pendulums. But do you believe the Mueller report in full should come out? Are you worried about that? And do you believe that your party should do, as some are saying, launch investigations against the people who put together the Mueller report?
I think that General Barr will do the right thing with respect to releasing the Mueller report. I voted to release it in its entirety. I do, however, trust General Barr if there are parts of that would compromise our national security. With respect to doing an investigation, I think we should. You know, this lasted 2 years. It took up a lot of time and resources, and you had people, high-ranking members of Congress like Adam Schiff that went on national television almost daily to talk about the information they had that would almost create a situation where President Trump could be impeached. And then the report comes out. There is no collusion. So I think there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. And, you know, do we reform how the Intelligence Committee operates? Do they need to be on national television every day talking and trying to spin different sides of the partisan story?
That's Congressman James Comer, the Republican of Kentucky. By the way, a good week to be a Republican.
It is a good week to be a Republican. It's always cyclical, so I'm sure that our day will come that will not be so good. But right now, it's a pretty good week to be a Republican.
Congressman Comer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And a note, the congressman asked, why didn't then-President Obama do more about Russian interference? Well, his administration did announce concerns about Russian interference. They thought it'd be a bombshell, but it was the same day the Access Hollywood Trump tape came out and was overlooked. Later this week, we'll take a deeper look at Obama and Russian interference.
Well, other than the Barr letter, there's another major development out of the Justice Department this week. The DOJ has changed its stance on the Affordable Care Act. It now supports striking down all of Obamacare, not just the law's pre-existing condition protections. The Trump administration's position comes in a legal filing before an appeals court that is considering the constitutionality of Obamacare. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hello there.
So the Department of Justice entered a legal filing yesterday with the Fifth Circuit Court in New Orleans, saying that it supports a lower court ruling that all of Obamacare is invalid. Why this change?
Well, it's sort of an evolution we've seen from the administration. At first, Justice Department officials had said there were grounds only to strike down the law's consumer protections, including those protections for people with pre-existing health conditions. The new position that's staked out by the Justice Department basically fully abandons the health law. This is relevant because the Affordable Care Act is part of federal law right now, mm-hmm. and now you've got the Justice Department basically abandoning that. It brings the administration in line with a number of Republican-controlled states that are arguing that no portion of the Affordable Care Act is constitutionally sound and it should be shut down. This is an effort led by a number of Republican-controlled states. There are counter-efforts that are being led by Democratically-controlled states.
Now, this is interesting coming just months after, I guess we're still just months after the midterm
yep.
elections, and President Trump campaigned along with a lot of Republicans saying that they supported keeping protections for pre-existing conditions, which is part of the Affordable Care Act. Here's the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell last June as Republicans campaigned before the midterms.
Everybody I know in the Senate, everybody is in favor of maintaining coverage for pre-existing conditions.
Okay, so he says everybody he knows is in favor of maintaining coverage for pre-existing conditions. But again, if the Justice Department is now saying we want the whole thing overturned, it's unconstitutional, that would mean
yeah.
getting rid of protections for pre-existing conditions.
Yes, Mitch McConnell must not know many people because there were lots of Republicans, including people who ran ads saying that they were going to protect pre-existing conditions, who had actually taken specific positions, including Martha McSally in Arizona and other Republicans. So that part's just not true. But the Trump administration had not gone this far. They argued last June, along when that clip was recorded, mm-hmm. that the penalty for not buying insurance was legally distinct from the other provisions of the Affordable Care Act, which could still stand. Now, that's not economically viable, but legally it's two different things. Then 2 months ago in the State of the Union address, Donald Trump declared that one of his priorities was to protect patients with pre-existing conditions. He keeps saying that. But this is kind of interesting because he spent most of 2017 trying to get legislation passed in a Republican-controlled House to repeal Obamacare. And then when that failed, the administration tried to use regulatory authority to do that. And then finally, the administration has decided to back this lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. It's highly unusual because the Justice Department, which is part of the executive branch, usually protects federal statutes in court, even when the president opposes them.
What would be the impact if the Justice Department is successful in getting the courts to overturn Obamacare, keeping in mind that the Affordable Care Act has made it through the courts many times now, including to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, a lot of it's been gutted. People on the Affordable Care Act will tell you that premiums are they're leveled to down, but coverage is lower, and copays and the premiums tend to be higher. So scrapping the law would lead to ultimately 32 million people being uninsured, more people than currently. By 2026. That was an estimate that was made in 2017. So the bottom line is this has to go through the courts and it'll still have to get to the Supreme Court. But if the government is successful at this, we will be back to where we were before Obamacare, with a whole lot of people who can't get insurance, can't afford it. And if you've got a pre-existing condition and you're not employed, you're out of luck.
Which is interesting, because that whole midterm election, I think if you look back on 2018, people would say it was all about health care and pre-existing conditions in particular.
For Democrats in particular, it was the number one issue. It was the most important issue.
That is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Skimming over the jungles in notorious Zone D, these C-123s of the 309th Air Commando Squadron have a unique assignment: defoliation. The spray materials used are harmless to humans, animals, soil, and water.
Well, they weren't. The chemical was Agent Orange, the herbicide used during the Vietnam War to deforest the land and deprive the Viet Cong of food and the ability to conceal themselves. But as we all know, the toxic chemicals also caused devastating health consequences for millions, the Americans serving in Vietnam and the Vietnamese on the ground. And a legal battle resulted in the biggest settlement in U.S. history. What's not known is that Americans, civilians, working stateside, were also exposed. Among them, the workers at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. Producer John Kalish tells their story in his new documentary, The Forgotten Civilians of Eglin Air Force Base. It was commissioned by Living Downstream, the environmental justice podcast series from Northern California Public Media. John, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, give us the setting for this. You spent time on the base. How were these workers exposed?
These workers were known as range technicians. There were some guys who went out in the test grid and picked up these little cardboard placards that were sprayed and brought it back to a lab so that they could see the results of the test sprays. And there were guys who were, I guess you'd call them cameramen. There were two guys needed to operate these huge 35-millimeter color film cameras that were the size of a refrigerator, and they're perched up on a platform, and they were heavily exposed to the spray.
Yeah, well, let's listen to some of the men that you met decades later, Tommy C. Brown and Clarence Hobbs. They were some of the cameramen you mentioned. And we're also going to hear from Billy McLean, who showed you where the base was dumping the barrels of Agent Orange when they were finished. Let's start with 72-year-old Tommy.
Sometimes it'd be like a mist. But I remember one time we got sprayed, and it was like mud. It was like a thin mud. It kind of covered us up. If I seen mist, I would not cut that camera off. I would sit right there on my position until they told me otherwise.
Sometimes we'd have to wipe our forehead running the camera, because it get on your forehead bad enough, you're afraid it's going to get in your eyes. They gave us instructions to wipe that camera down and clean it every night. But they never told us anything about wiping ourselves down.
They brought barrels of Agent Orange and dumped them in the head of a creek out there, a steep creek. It'd be 50, 60 feet down there to the bottom. And they just roll these barrels out of pickup trucks. I seen them doing that, and I've been down there and seen the barrels down in the bottom of the creek. And that happened, I don't know how often, but there was many barrels that was put down in there.
Now, keep in mind, Robin, there was not the consciousness we have today about toxic chemicals. Mm-hmm. And there certainly was no warning given by the employer of these civilian employees, a company called Vitro. There was no warning that they were dealing with a product, a chemical product, that was contaminated with a highly toxic compound known as dioxin. And They were warned to wash the vans down, but they just didn't put two and two together. And so they didn't think that this stuff was dangerous.
Yeah. And by the way, it's horrible to hear them talking about it, knowing we now know what it was, that it was Agent Orange. But things started to go terribly wrong.
That's right. And not only were they affected, but they believe, and this is certainly something that parallels the claims made by Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange, they believe their wives were affected and that their children were also affected by their exposure to the herbicide.
You visited one family in the documentary. Let's listen.
My daughter, when she was 3 years of age, she just got sick. She just became limp. They finally decided it was her kidneys. She had a kidney disease.
That's Linda Yates, the widow of Jack Yates, who collected the cards on the spray grid, among other tasks at Eglin.
Our daughter was a daddy's girl. When he would come home, she would run out of the house and jump on him and hug him and all, rubbing all over his clothes, just sticky, saturated with Agent Orange. Well, his clothes, I might not wash them for 3 days. What I feel bad about is I let them set till I'd get a big load and wash clothes with the two kids, mine, Jack's. I did not know how dangerous that chemical was. When I did get to wash them, you could just stand them up. They were like starched. They were stiff, sticky and stiff. The notion that they brought home clothes that were tainted with dioxin, a highly toxic byproduct of Agent Orange, and unwittingly exposed their loved ones to it, haunts some of the former Eglin workers. Bobby Gunter wonders if his late wife's neurological problems resulted from dioxin exposure, or whether his stepson died at an early age because of it.
He was 6 years old when I worked there at Vitra with the spray machines. He died of leukemia. I'm wondering if I was the cause of it, because it was on my clothes when I went home. My clothes was washed with their clothes. My wife washed them, you know. I beat myself up for all these years. Was it the cause of it?
John Kalish, that is heartbreaking.
Yes, and I would point out that the claims that family members suffered miscarriages or birth defects is more controversial than the understanding that the men who were directly exposed are suffering from a variety of medical ailments.
Yeah. What are some of those ailments?
There's a list of presumptive diseases for which Vietnam veterans can win disability benefits relating to Agent Orange exposure. And this list includes leukemia, diabetes, lymphoma, Parkinson's disease, a nervous system disorder, liver dysfunction, variety of cancers, especially soft tissue sarcomas, and a terrible skin rash known as chloracne, which a lot of these men in Florida have had to deal with.
Well, you tell a great story about how a man named Von Jones finally made the connection between the illnesses that these now older civilian workers were having and the chemicals that they'd worked with. What did he tell you about how he started connecting the dots?
Of course, this is many, many years, in fact, decades later, when he was at a clinic getting his regular chemotherapy, and he looks across the hall and he notices this supervisor from the Air Force base, and that guy was there for cancer and chemotherapy, and they started talking and realized that all these guys they had worked with had either died or were suffering from some of these Agent Orange presumptive diseases.
You know, this was, as you said, decades later. Had they not heard about the huge class action lawsuit by Vietnam vets? You know, the settlement was worth $180 million. In 1984, that was the largest award in American history. You'd think they would have connected the dots sooner.
One of the Eglin civilian workers did tell me that he remembers hearing news coverage of the Agent Orange case, and he turned to his wife and said, "I got drenched with that stuff." But I suppose it just went by a lot of the other men.
Well, finally, they brought in a lawyer who was involved with that Vietnam veterans lawsuit. Tell us about him.
His name is Victor Yannicone, and he's a kind of legendary environmental lawyer who in the late 60s practically single-handedly litigated the ban of DDT. And he brought the Agent Orange class action on behalf of the veterans in 1979. And he is willing to come back and jump in the ring again, so to speak, to represent these civilian workers at Eglin.
Along with a local attorney, Rusty Sanders. Let's listen.
Mr. Yannakun and I, we know what the hell we're doing. But these companies have tremendous resources. They're not going to bow easily. So we need a public interest consortium to help bring these civilians justice. We're confident that if we have our day in court, and when we do, that justice will be served.
John, having done this reporting, are you confident that they'll have their day in court? And will enough of them still be here to have that day in court?
Well, to answer your latter question, I should tell you that 2 weeks after my reporting trip, the last guy I interviewed died from a very serious case of cancer ravaging his body. And I am told that one of the men who we heard in this segment is in very bad shape now. So some of them may not be around to celebrate. To answer your first question, will they have their day in court? It's unclear because the two lawyers who are willing to bring this clearly do not have the deep pockets it's necessary to go up against these chemical companies that have huge resources to fight this in court. It could be argued that the defendants or the possible defendants, which include the manufacturers of Agent Orange, including Dow and Monsanto, that they and the company that took over Vitro, they're basically waiting for these guys to die. Mm-hmm. And so the two lawyers, Sanders and Yannakun, they're looking for a personal injury law firm with deep pockets to come forward and fund this litigation. They can't – they're two relatively small-time solo practitioners. They don't feel that they can do this themselves.
Well, they, as I said, they also need public interest, and you've helped create that. That's John Kalish. We'll link you to his documentary, The Forgotten Civilians of Eglin Air Force Base. And John, obviously you'll stay on this story.
I will.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow, British lawmakers will vote on a series of proposals for how to leave the European Union after Parliament voted to take control of the Brexit process from Prime Minister Theresa May last night. Let's bring in the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, in London. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jeremy. You know, one of the options they should have would be, help, get me out of here. I'm a politician.
Well, what exactly are they going to be voting on tomorrow?
What they're going to do is they're going to vote on a range of options. Because remember why they're doing it. This is a humiliating defeat for Theresa May. This was Parliament sort of taking back control, saying, we don't like your plan. So this is their attempt to see if they can come up with an alternative. So what they're going to do is vote on a range of options, presumably from the very hardest of Brexits. That would be Britain leaving the European Union without any form of arrangement, all the way through to just cancelling Brexit. And you would imagine somewhere in between would be options such as staying much closer to the European Union, staying in its single market and its customs union, and of course the option, one would imagine, of a second referendum.
Now, I remember the last time they voted down Theresa May's deal, they actually tried out some votes on some of these things and they voted against them then. Is it different this time?
It may be in the sense that when that happened, it was with both the two main parties, the governing Conservative Party and the main opposition Labour Party, their party managers insisting, using discipline, saying, right, you've got to vote this way or that way. I mean, I think what will be interesting is if there's what's known as a free vote, which is sort of like free love but not quite as much fun, and then we'll see whether there is a majority around something that MPs could agree on.
So they can vote for what they really think, you're saying?
Well, yes, but I'm not sure whether that's going to happen. But an awful lot of people listening will be thinking, there's got to be a catch here somewhere. Why didn't they do it before? And brave listener, you are right. There is a catch too, really. I mean, the first is, it's perfectly possible that there may just not be an option that a majority of MPs can unite behind. Mm-hmm. The second potential catch is, let's say they do, but let's say this thing that they opt for is a sort of softer version of Brexit. Then what? I mean, does Theresa May just do yet another U-turn and accept that? Or does the entire government collapse because it will have strayed so far from what it promised on Brexit?
How likely is a total crash out at this point? And now the date that we're talking about for that would be April the 12th.
I think it's still a possibility, but of course the majority of MPs are against it. I mean, in many ways, all the options are still open. That is one. As amazingly would be Theresa May's deal sort of coming down on the sort of outside stretch at the last minute just because, you know, everything else might fail. And another option that I certainly wouldn't rule out is just a sort of another delay but with no particular purpose. And then the final one, of course, is just a complete sort of political meltdown in this country. The government collapsing. I mean, it's already disintegrating around us, collapsing, and there having to be another general election. Not that that would necessarily solve anything.
Either way, do you think Theresa May holds on to power?
I think she is a prime minister whose hours are numbered. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think the authority has drained away from her credibility. But the reason why she's still there, Jeremy, is that most people have figured it out, that in many ways it wouldn't matter how you shuffled this particular pack if you could think of the 650 MPs as a sort of pack of cards. It may just be possible that you cannot achieve a winning hand with Brexit, no matter who's in charge.
That is the BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Besides claiming total vindication, President Trump is vowing to go after unnamed critics now that his attorney general says the Russia investigation found no evidence of election-related conspiracy with Russians and that it was inconclusive on obstruction of justice. Here's President Trump in the Oval Office yesterday.
We've gone through a period of really bad things happening. Those people will certainly be looked at. I've been looking at them for a long time, and I'm saying, why haven't they been looked at? They lied to Congress. Many of them, you know who they are. They've done so many evil things.
Joining us now is Tim O'Brien, executive editor of Bloomberg Opinion and author of the biography Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald. Tim, welcome back to Here and Now.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, let's first talk about the tactic that the president is using now. His former advisor, Steve Bannon, told Yahoo News that Trump will now go full animal against his enemies. How do you think this will play out?
Well, I think it's up to the public ultimately to decide whether or not they have a stomach for retribution. And obviously, I think the president and his camp is trying with a very broad brush to paint both the investigation of his relationship with Russia and both at the federal level and within the media as being part of retribution against him. And I think Bob Mueller's finding that there was no collusion gives him momentum and fodder to make that a talking point. But the conclusions that Mueller, you know, ultimately arrived at weren't completely dispositive, and there's still a lot of things in here that people need to contemplate and look at, I believe.
And all we know at this point is what the Attorney General Barr has said about what is in the Mueller report because nobody has seen it yet. The conservative talk host Laura Ingraham urged Trump on her show last night to use this moment to reset his president. She said his presidency. She said gloating won't get you reelected and neither will the Mueller report. Do you think that that's in his DNA to do that?
I don't think it's in his DNA. I also think that I don't normally find common ground with Laura Ingraham and some of her mm-hmm. observations about political dynamics. But I think that the election in 2020 will be won around issues like healthcare, jobs, the economy, and immigration. I don't think the Russia investigation is forward in most people's minds. It is, however, a serious national security issue, and it's a real issue around governance at the federal level, and it matters. I don't think that Trump typically gets away from holding grudges. He's a fighter. He likes to fight back. I think that's what some of his supporters like about him. But he also is not very self-regulating. And when he feels wounded or when he feels unfairly treated, he tends to battle back.
Now, he said he doesn't mind if the whole Mueller report is released. Do you believe that he doesn't mind if that happens?
Well, I would say – I would remind everyone that he said the same thing about his tax returns when he was a candidate. He said when the time came, he would be very comfortable with releasing all of his tax returns. And, you know, that was almost 4 years ago.
We still don't have them.
And we still don't have them. I don't think he's comfortable with the idea of the whole Mueller report being released. If he was, you wouldn't have, I think, Mitch McConnell already stepping out and saying – that he doesn't support a full release for it. McConnell would be following the president's guidance around that.
You say that the Mueller report and the Barr letter is not the end of Trump and his family's legal jeopardy. What do you think happens next then?
Well, he's subject to about a dozen investigations, either through U.S. attorney's offices, state attorney's general offices, regulatory bodies, and then five congressional committees. And they're looking at stuff that I think is more directly of concern to him than the Mueller investigation ever was, really. I don't think – I personally never felt that collusion was a thing he had to worry about. I did think obstruction of justice was something he had to worry about and should be continued to be examined. But he obstructed potentially an investigation of collusion that may not have touched him. The stuff going on in these other investigations get to his business history, what his transition team was doing financially, the inauguration, and possible financial conflicts of interest in the White House that are ongoing and compromise his policymaking capacity. And I think that there's potential legal jeopardy in all of that. You've seen some of that come up in the Michael Cohen prosecution. You've seen it come up in the investigation of the Trump Foundation, right, et cetera, et cetera.
That is Tim O'Brien, executive editor of Bloomberg Opinion. His book is called Trump Nation. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, in Georgia, a fight in the state legislature is dividing even the most ardent gun rights advocates. The issue is over constitutional carry laws, which allow people to carry firearms in public without a license. WABE's Lisa Hagan explains what's happening in Georgia.
Nearly every morning during the legislative session, Patrick Parsons records a live video across the street from the Georgia Capitol. It's not the most glamorous moment.
I'll probably go over there on top of the trash can and do it, which is where I usually do it.
Parsons is the executive director of Georgia Gun Owners, and he's got one goal: pass constitutional carry.
So in Georgia, we have a weapons license. A lot of states have permits. Constitutional carry simply makes the weapons license optional.
Having a license means you can carry a concealed gun in all the places state law allows. But Parsons doesn't like the idea that Americans need permission to carry. Under the bill he supports, you could still get a weapons license. You just don't have to. More than a dozen states have adopted some version of this kind of law, and others are working on it.
South Dakota just became a new constitutional carry state. Iowa is very close. So you can imagine if you're a Second Amendment supporter, you're seeing this all over the internet.
But not every gun owner in Georgia is convinced it's a smart move.
Fire at will.
On a Saturday morning in Livonia, Georgia, Wade Haley is helping run the monthly pistol shooting competition at Guns and Gear. He doesn't think the weapons license system in Georgia is perfect.
But I don't think it should be just every Joe Blow that doesn't have a record running around with a gun on their hip.
He says he sees most of the debate over constitutional carry happening on the internet. On Facebook, gun trading forums, and online, it feels like people with his stance that constitutional carry isn't necessary are in the minority.
Because they're gall gung-ho, I'm a Second Amendment supporter, and in order to be a true Second Amendment supporter, I've got to support this. This has got to be the way it is.
Georgia House Representative Alan Powell stopped by the gun store. Powell agrees with Haley.
The buzzword of constitutional carry, that sounds sexy, you know, really popular among the extreme Second Amendment supporters.
Powell, a Republican, is no squish himself when it comes to gun rights.
They had me on the front page of the New York Times and the LA Times simultaneously saying that I was probably the most dangerous man in America.
That was 5 years ago when he helped pass a state law that came to be known as Guns Everywhere. It allowed licensed gun owners in Georgia to carry guns into bars, schools, and some government buildings. It's one of several pro-gun measures Georgia's enacted over the years, using the state's weapons license system.
I'd much rather keep working toward expanding the areas that law-abiding citizens can carry a weapon.
He's not against the idea of constitutional carry in theory, but it doesn't feel like a smart political move to him. And there is another factor. Georgia Gun Owners, the group behind the bill, has kind of an all-or-nothing strategy, aggressively accusing politicians of not going far enough and urging supporters to contact them. Here's Patrick Parsons again in a recent video.
Speaker David Ralston and other weak-kneed politicians like Heath Clark, Alan Powell, Bill Hitchens, all down the line are doing everything in their power to make sure that Georgia does not become a constitutional carry state.
Thousands of people watch these videos every day. Still, the tactic has not convinced Powell to stick his neck out for Parsons' cause.
Why the hell do we want to bring an issue up that we know is going to be defeated? Because if you get defeated on a bill, then that shows a sign of weakness of your issues.
Constitutional carry looks unlikely to make it anywhere near the governor's desk in 2019. So Parsons' strategy may not change gun policy in Georgia this year, but the movement he's part of does seem to be resonating with a growing number of gun owners around the country. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Hagan.
And Lisa's story comes to us from the Guns in America Reporting Project.
Apple is getting into the business of publishing and credit cards and video streaming. At Apple's big rollout of new services yesterday, it had Oprah and Steven Spielberg and Reese Witherspoon talking about their new Apple projects. But why didn't have more video of those projects? Well, our next guest has a guess. Let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Peter Kafka is executive editor at Recode. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
So that was your question, and we want to take it up. But in the meantime, just, yeah, you know, paint the picture for us. Talk about what else Apple offered, including they had Apple News Plus. This is connecting magazine publishers with a huge audience that uses Apple devices. Paint the picture for us.
Yeah, so the common theme here, Apple does these events periodically, and they always show off new hardware they're going to sell, whether it's an AirPod or an Apple Watch or a new iPhone. This was different. There was zero hardware. This is all services. This is all stuff they want to sell to people who already, in most cases, have Apple products to generate a new revenue stream. So there's a credit card, there's going to be a gaming service, there's this video service, there's a video store, and there is this revamped magazine service.
Yeah, the magazine service, by the way, they're doing subscriptions, $9.99 a month. But that just raised a question for us because many of the publications they're offering charge that much or more for access to their site. So how does that work?
The very short answer here is it's a classic internet line, make it up on volume. This is an old product the magazine publishers themselves had put together. I think it was originally $15 a month. It used to be called Texture. No one used it. And it was sort of a Netflix for magazines. And what Apple has done is basically taken that concept, taken those licenses, sort of basically revamped the product and added in a couple new services like the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times. And now it's $10 a month and you can consume anything you want. And yeah, there's the obvious question, aren't you going to cannibalize the existing businesses?
Yeah.
And the slightly more nuanced answer is Apple and some of the people participating in it say, well, we haven't gotten very far building this stuff on our own, so why not let Apple sell more stuff at a lower price for us? And then there's also an argument that says, look, if you really love The New Yorker or The Wall Street Journal and you really want to read these things, you're better off getting a subscription to those publications. It's a better experience. Apple's not going to say that, but that's the fact. It's meant for sort of a more general browser.
Hmm. Okay, we'll talk about this video streaming because this was the big centerpiece of the day. Apple TV Plus, and as we said, they brought out Steven Spielberg and Oprah Winfrey to talk about the product. But as you point out, your headline of your piece in Recode is, we still don't know what's in Apple's streaming service, how much it will cost, or why we should pay for it. They didn't have a lot of video.
Yeah, Apple's been telling people for a couple years, look, we're going to build this stuff. We hired these guys from Sony to make us a lot of TV shows, maybe a couple movies. Every couple weeks in the Hollywood trades, they announce a new thing with a new brand name, director or actor or writer. And that's all we've known for a couple years. So we're expecting to finally see some stuff yesterday. And they really didn't show it. We don't know why Apple hasn't doing that yet.
Would you have a guess?
My guess is that this is in many ways aimed at Wall Street. Apple's been telling Wall Street for a while, hey, our hardware business is sales are going to slow. It's sort of inevitable. The iPhone is a once-in-a-lifetime product. We don't have a new iPhone, so we're going to augment that with service revenue. And if you're on Wall Street, look, we're serious about this. Here are five different things we're doing.
And here's Oprah.
And here's Oprah's in.
Right, even though there's no picture. So that's your guess. It wasn't for us, the consumers. It was for Wall Street and investors. What do you think it will cost, and how do you think it will work? And will it compete with Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and everybody else?
So I'm reasonably sure it cannot compete directly with Netflix, et cetera, even if Apple says internally they call it a Netflix killer, because it's at best it's going to have a couple shows a month. And maybe you'll like the Oprah show, and maybe you'll like the Steven Spielberg show. But generally, when you sign up for a service like Netflix or HBO, you're buying a couple shows you like and then a lot of other stuff, like old movies, old TV shows, stuff that you're going to watch when you're not watching Game of Thrones. Yeah. And Apple won't have that at launch. So my theory is they're going to make this a very, very, very low-priced product that they'll bundle with other stuff, so it will be effectively free or very low cost. Apple refuses to talk about pricing, so maybe they do think they can sell it for more than that. I mean, it certainly can't cost as much as Netflix or Hulu.
Well, Apple also debuted a credit card. It's both virtual and titanium. Is it really titanium?
Titanium. They said so, with laser etching, which got a good giggle out of the crowd. But yeah, it's really meant to be something that lives in your phone.
Does that mean the company is now competing with the banks that helped Apple build Apple Pay?
Yeah, if you're using Apple Pay, you probably have linked it to a bank like Chase, and now Apple is essentially saying you should move all that stuff over to Goldman. And it's really sort of an extension of the Apple Pay thing that you may already be using on your phone.
Did Apple, with all this new these services, as you said, not devices but the services, did Apple make any promises or comments about privacy?
Yeah, Apple for a long time, and this goes back to Steve Jobs, Apple has focused on privacy and the fact that they're not in the advertising business, with some exceptions. But so they definitely leaned into that in yesterday's announcement. Multiple times they made references to privacy and not selling your data. They even promised that Goldman Sachs, which is very much in the data mining business, will not be selling your data, at least with regards to this credit card. And several times they got a big round of applause whenever they announced that.
Yeah. Peter Kafka, executive editor at Recode. Still some questions after Apple's big preview yesterday, but I am sure he will find the answers. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.